Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
When your love has moved away, you must face yourself and you must say, I remember better days. Don't you cry, 'cause she is gone. She is only moving on, chasing mirrors through a haze.
Yeah, so the name of the book is No Bad Ways, and with a little subtitle called Talking Story with Mickey Munoz. So I'll read what follows. There are no bad waves, only a poor choice of equipment and a lousy attitude. A wave is universal energy, changing in response to environment and circumstance. Any wave can be ridden if you combine the right tools with the body and spirit. Matching the board to the wave lets you flow instead of fight. Attitude is the ultimate piece of equipment. No matter how good the wave or how tuned your board, a lousy attitude definitely ruins your day. Surfing is dynamic and constantly changing. Flow with the power and dance with the wave. And you really realize what's going on.
Welcome back to part two of our interview with Mickey Munoz. This is Surf Splendor, and I'm your host, David Scales. If you haven't yet listened to part one of our interview with Mickey, I encourage you push pause on this interview right now. Go back and download part one and listen to that first. It's two episodes ago on Surf Splendor. And Mickey, he gives his take on modern surfing with his opinions about John Florence, Kelly Slater, Gabriel Medina, but he also unpacks his history, talks about his experiences early on in Malibu with iconic kind of pioneer surfboard shapers, Joe Quigg, Matt Kivlin, his experience seeing Phil Edwards for the very first time, and then also discusses in detail his relationship with Mickey Dora, and how that helped our Mickey define his own sense of morality and his own code of ethics. So that's a great intro into this conversation. So again, go back, listen to that, and then come back and click play right here. All right? I know you didn't come to listen to me talk. So without further ado, part two of our interview with Mickey Munoz.
Through surfing, because I worked in the first Gidget movie, I got in SAG, and which was hard to, it was expensive to get into, and and hard to get into. And so it was an opportunity to do that. So I ended up doing some stunt work. And
yeah, what was your exact role in the film, in Gidget?
Well, I got to do some doubling for Sandra Dee in the surf side of it, because I'm, you know, short enough, and my line is I used to look good in a bikini, but now my skin is wrinkled, my tits are sagging. So I tried to teach her how to surf, and you know, she was this skinny little Hollywood starlet who was great, ended up being a really good actress, but you know, it's fall, the water's cold, you know, she no wetsuits, and,
yeah,
and you know, it was really hard for her. So so I got to do some of the stunt work. I worked on the set as, you know, doing as a lifeguard, as a grip, as a, you know, all around, because it's second unit and on the beach, so I got a summer of work out of it, and better pay than normal.
In the film, are you surfing then? Or is there footage of you surfing in the film?
There is some, and I think I'm doing a tandem thing. I can't even remember. In fact, there's a big Gidget event coming up this weekend at Coronado, and it's a Gidget documentary or something, and they're making a big deal out of it. So I'm off for there. I'll probably see myself on screen.
Oh, wow. So they're asking you to participate in the documentary?
Oh, they've already done the documentary.
Got it.
Yeah,
got it.
So this is just kind of a screening. But anyway.
Gotcha.
So, but the other, I did get to do, I got to double Mickey Rooney in a TV series called Mickey, and so he and I are about the same height and a little different shape, but same name, Mickey, and I hired on to do this water skiing stunt. I'd never water skied in my life, and I hired on as an expert, and so luckily a friend of mine took me down with his ski boat and gave me a half a day lesson in water skiing, and he was a really good athlete,
was
by
he?
The way, and also was probably a way better stuntman than me, but they, you know, they can't gamble on him.
Sure.
And I don't know that he had water skied, and it was a pretty tricky thing. I kind of introduced a surfboard into the stunt business, and basically Mickey Rooney's getting water ski lessons from this woman instructor, and she and I are standing on the dock, and we're holding on to the ski line, and it's coiled up on the dock, and we're standing in our skis, and she's giving instruction, and the ski boat takes off, thinking that they signaled, and so I fly off the dock and on two skis, land in the water, and land on my back, and then I get towed on my back with my skis over my head, which is not so easy.
Sure.
And of course the instructress gets pulled off the dock, but she's now skiing, and she comes over and rescues me, and then I climb, and we do this tandem ski thing. I kick my skis off, and
so you've got to go from laying on your back being planed across the water
now
to climbing on her.
Yeah,
got
and
it.
So this is not an easy stunt to pull off.
Yeah,
and so I finally made a board, a plywood board that I strapped underneath my shirt onto my back so that I had a better planing surface.
Sure.
And I wasn't strong enough to hold onto the ski line and get pulled onto a plane, so I had the ski line tied into that piece of wood, right?
Okay.
Coming out of the back of my neck.
Oh my gosh.
And then they would launch me off my surfboard. I'd get on the back of my board with the nose sticking up, and the guy would punch it and pull me on the, you know, on the board till the board purled, and I'm now planing, right?
Okay.
So I pulled it off, you know, four or five or six or eight takes, right, like that. But one time, instead of planing up, I planed down, and the guy didn't turn around. And this is before, you know, they didn't have walkies, and they, you know.
No safety crew on hand.
It was pretty loose, right?
Sure.
So the guy pulls me down underwater, and luckily, I broke the ski line.
It broke. Because it would have planed you way under.
Oh, I was planing down. Okay. At speed. I mean, we're talking full-on inboard V8
right.
Cadillac engine in the speedboat, you know, in the boat. I mean, or a straight eight, I don't remember, but it was a big engine, big, you know, powerful
right.
ski boat. And yeah, I mean, I was just this rag doll on the end. But
the line broke, so.
In the end, we pulled it off,
okay.
right? We did pull it off. And so they rehired me to do stunts
sure.
in the following episodes. And so I did some fights and falls and stuff like that. And actually, Mickey, because I'd never done that either. You
mm-hmm.
know? So he kind of took me under his wing and showed me, you know, how to do all that stuff. And
so, awesome. So yeah. You had a little friendship?
Well, a little bit, you know, I mean, whatever you can, you know, on the set.
Yeah.
Know? And so anyway, the series didn't sell. I mean, they did 13 weeks and I probably worked on three shows or four
right.
shows or something, but it was something.
And, oh, yeah.
And then I never, you know, and then to drive again, you know, being a surfer, driving to Hollywood to hustle.
Yeah.
You know, I just, that wasn't in me. And I knew people, and whenever there was a water something to do,
you'd get the call.
If it was appropriate, I'd get hired. So I did some other stuff.
Well, let me ask you this.
I did some diving things too, you know, where I worked for, you know, we did, we blew up the Capo Pier and the pier in Long Beach. And
I want to get into that. But let me ask you first, like with Gidget specifically, because it was a surf movie, you know, I mean, the other work, it's surf related, but it's not viewed by the public as a kind of exploitation of surfing. Gidget, I think, the critics would argue that, like, this is going to make Malibu more crowded next year after this movie comes out.
No question.
Did you have any apprehension or regrets after doing it in that respect, or are you proud of the work? I mean, what role does it play in your life?
No, the only thing I'm proud of is I came up with the line. My skin, I used to look good in a bikini.
That's a good line.
My skin is wrinkled and my tits are sagging.
It is a good line.
I mean, you know, surfing was already coming of age even before that. San Fernando Valley was driving out Malibu Canyon and learning to surf at Malibu. I mean, even before Gidget, it was like, well, maybe we should design this kit that you can buy in the surf shop that's the tail of a surfboard that you can strap onto the back of your car
and
then, you know, and put a towel under it and call yourself a surfer and not have to go in the water. So, I mean, by then already it was, I wouldn't say saturated, but it was becoming popular.
And that's why Hollywood
made the film to begin with.
Right.
Because there was, you know, surfing was already coming of age. So, I mean, kind of in the Dora consciousness, if I don't do it, somebody else will. Well, you know, I'm married. I got a couple kids. I need the work. I can use the money.
Yeah.
It's better money than I could make any other way. And something I love to do, you know, and why not?
Yeah.
And it kind of got me into the, you know, into SAG and stuff where, you know, I ended up doing some commercials and some other stuff. So all through my life, it's you know, it's been a little bit of income here and there and fun to do.
How did Shaping Surfboards fit into that professionally? Was it simultaneous while you were getting occasional acting work? And did you get into Shaping Surfboards to make a living, or did you have kind of design ideas that weren't being met by the other guys shaping boards that you needed to you know, create for your own surfing?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of both.
Okay.
I mean, I needed to make a living, and what better way to make a living than to design and shape your own boards? And you know, when we did the Tom Morey nose riding contest, you know, we conceived of a nose riding design, and so I went to Phil, because Phil was the master shaper, and he and I could talk, you know, surfboard design, and so we kind of conceived of that design together, and Phil shaped it. So
and it became incredibly important.
Well, pretty good. I mean, I guess, you know, there is some controversy about actually who won that, but, you know, they gave me first prize, so.
What was the controversy?
Well, that there had been a miscounting of time or something, and so, you know, there was, at one time, there was a thinking that Mike Henson might have won it, not me, and anyway, and it was, you know, anyway, whatever
yeah,
it was,
sure.
It, you know, it ended up as it ended up, and the design concepts that we came up with turned out to be very valid, and
right.
Even today are still incorporated, you know, subtle parts of that design are still incorporated in boards today. So,
right.
You know, out of this specialty stuff, you know, when you take a design and you take it all the way out to the extremes,
right.
You learn from it, and yes, it's extreme. Yeah, it did nose ride really well, but it didn't do something else very good.
Mm.
So you take what you learn out there and you incorporate it with some other stuff, and you try and come up with this, you know, not everybody can have two dozen boards, and not
right.
Everybody wants two dozen boards, because there are a lot of, because the ocean is so dynamic that one wave might dig, you know, you might want that great nose rider, but the next wave after that, you might want something else. So, you know, you're really trying to find this kind of medium that works pretty good all around, unless you're, okay, we're at Chopu now and we're
yeah.
doing stand-up barrels, you know, double, triple overhead barrels. Okay, this is what I want for that.
Right.
And so, but most surfing isn't like that.
Sure.
So I got into shaping because, you know, back to my quig days of being a paperweight, and back to, you know, trying to make my own board and having ideas and wanting to express those and make a living too. I mean, how could it be better?
Yeah.
It's about as good as it gets.
Yeah.
You know, it's a circle, you know, it helps complete that circle of being able to ride and make what you ride.
Well, talking about your shaping career specifically, you went to work for Hobie for some time.
Yep.
Were there any other labels that you worked under along the way? Or
I shaped for Donald Takeyama a little bit.
That's right.
I actually wasn't good enough to shape for him. He's really a good shaper, a perfectionist, but I did, you know, I
yeah.
did shape boards for him, and I guess they were acceptable, but I always respected his designs, and not necessarily that was my idea of design, but I respected his designs
sure.
for what he did, and he was an incredible shaper. So, and from a quality standpoint, the quality of his boards were just exquisite.
Right.
And
so I would assume
not that Hobies weren't too,
no, of course,
because I think they were.
But you could probably glean from each of those people when you're working side by side with them, I would think.
Oh, for sure.
And improve your own skill set.
So, you know, I've always cherished being able to share that, you know, with other shapers. And, you know, of course, my brother-in-law, Terry Martin, you know, was one of the best of the best shapers. And, you know, I loved watching him shape. I'd go in and watch him shape, and we'd talk design and shaping and forever and ever. And Phil the same way, although Phil and I didn't totally agree on designs, but master craftsman, incredible craftsman and artist.
Yeah. What, did you have your own label throughout those years on the side, or when did that come about?
I did. I'm not an entrepreneur, you know, point me in the right direction and hopefully I'll get there. But I was a Hobie team writer, and then, you know, Hobie started doing name designs. And
okay.
So, you know, there was a Corky Carroll design Mike Purpose, actually. I think he did some too. And anyway, all through the Hobie era, he had named writers and would have designs, and I got to shape a lot of those as well as I had my own.
Yeah.
And my own label, which Hobie manufactured and marketed and sold.
Okay.
To supplement.
Do you still shape today?
I do.
To what degree? And I mean, are you just working exclusively with custom orders that people ask you for?
No, I kind of got away from that a little bit because I wanted to concentrate more on prototyping I got involved with Surf Tech with Randy French, and Randy had come up with a proprietary process for production type board, and it had been done in the past but never had been done in the quality and the quality that Randy came up with. And so I could kind of see the writing on the wall that being a production shaper, there was a time when you could make pretty good money doing it, but because of the way the industry had gone and so forth, there was proportionally less and less money in production shaping. It's a lot of frickin' work.
And, oh yeah.
And I could see that, you know, the computer is only as good as the input.
Hmm.
Right?
Sure.
It takes an artist to input it. And so the argument, well, they're not hand-shaped. Well, yeah, they are. That original prototype was not only hand-shaped, but tuned for years and years and years and years and years. It's a composite of all that experience. And there were some learning curves in there because you're working with different materials that have different characteristics, but the upside is that, guess what, actually the manufacturer, the distributor, all the people that are in line in the business of making surfboards can actually make a living doing it.
Right.
I mean,
that's sustainable.
That's sustainable, and you as the customer, you're getting a board that's more durable. You can replicate it. So let's say you go to Hawaii. Well, rather than schlepping a surfboard in a bag through the LA International and paying the price to get it on the airplane and all of that, you can rent or buy or ship, pre-ship a board over there and leave it, and you hurt if you the board gets run over or whatever, you can go to the store and buy one just like it that you can rely on.
Right.
Where custom, yeah, hopefully every new custom board is better than the last one, but that doesn't necessarily follow. So,
sure.
So there were a lot of advantages to it, and so I kind of saw that and got on board with Randy early on. And in fact, at that time I was Bill Stewart was manufacturing the Hobie label boards, and I was shaping for, and he was doing my label also, and so I was basically shaping production boards,
yeah,
for Bill Stewart,
yeah,
who was having them glassed and marketing and selling them, right? So Bill kept going, oh no, you shouldn't get involved with that, no, don't get the, you know, da, da, da. And I finally went, you know what, Bill, I got to make a living just like you, and right now you don't have enough orders to satisfy what I need to make a living, so I'm going to go do something on my own here,
mm-hmm,
which is what you would do.
Yeah.
Which he would have done.
Sure.
And so that's what I did. And so I walked in the back door of his shop with the very first sample 11-footer that I made for SurfTech. And Terry was there and a bunch of other shapers and stuff, and they're all eager to see it, and they're going, wow, this is really light. And they're looking at it and going, yeah, it's really nice, the finish is good, it's really professional, it looks great. And Bill walked in, you know, and he kind of looked at the board and he goes, can we jump on it? I go, heck yes, let's both jump on it. So we put it fin down on the floor, and Bill and I got right in the center of it and jumped up and down. Bill looks at it, eyeballs it, kind of went, you know, I could just see this little wry smile on his face. That afternoon, he called Randy, and he had a model.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Converted him.
Yeah. Well, temporarily.
Okay.
Then he decided that, no, this was hurting his business, and this wasn't a good thing, and he wrote some pretty vehement articles against him and pulled his model from SurfTech. So,
okay.
But Randy went into it and he goes, okay, I could come into this and undercut the market because there's enough margin, but I'd rather come in at the same level as custom and just espouse the advantages.
Sure.
You know, I'm not saying they're better than or way better than,
yeah,
but here are the advantages. You make your choice. You can have one of each or
right,
two of each.
Sure.
Right? I'm going to come in at the same dollar level.
Right.
But everybody in line, Mickey, you're going to make a nice, nice royalty on this. The manufacturer's making their money. Randy, SurfTech gets their cut. The distributors,
yeah,
and the retailers were making more than on a. I mean, that board originally landed in California was less than you could buy the materials to make a custom board.
Where was the production being done?
Thailand.
Okay. So
at a very, very advanced a facility that made very high level composite.
Yeah.
Not only boards, but other things for aerospace and stuff.
You've ridden enough of the SurfTech boards and enough polyurethane traditional custom boards. Strictly from a surfing standpoint, can you identify a difference between the two? Or,
yeah, so polyester urethane foam. Polyester resin compared to epoxy resin is almost night and day.
Sure.
Polyester resin is not as strong. It's a different chemical linkage than the epoxy resin. So you get a new custom polyurethane, polyester created board. When they're new, they're great.
Sure.
They work great. Kids, though, you know, the boards kept getting thinner and thinner and thinner and lighter and lighter and lighter. And the kids are doing, you know, there's more impact on the board. So every time that board flexes, it's cracking microscopically. And you know, kids would come into the shop and go, oh, my board's waterlogged. No, I don't think so. I bet if we weighed your board when it went out of this door until you put wax on it, you know, you weigh it now and weigh the wax and weigh if it's got any dings that you've fixed and whatever, you know, that board's going to weigh pretty close to what it weighed when it went out the door. It's not waterlogged. It's dead.
Yeah.
You've broken down the matrix to the point where it's no longer recoiling. And so early on, because I had been building boats and composite boats, I changed my whole quiver over to epoxy. Not necessarily
EPS,
but even with urethane foam, the epoxy resin composite was a better choice. And it turns out that EPS, because of the nature of the core, you know, you'd think from a engineering standpoint, we'll use Clark foam blanks as a model. When they're pressure blown in the molds, it's pretty ideal because they expand, and as they expand and the foam goes to the edges of the mold, if you will, it gets compressed. So if you were to cut that blank in half, a cross section, and look at it, the center cells would be more open, and as you get to the skin on the outside of the blank, they get more dense. Well, that's a pretty ideal, from an engineering standpoint, that's pretty ideal. But surfing is this sort of dynamic where the board is part of the characteristics of the board is its flex, how it's reacting,
right,
flex wise and again, back to the polyester urethane example, after 2 months of you know, 180 pounds up and down and pounding on that 2.5-inch thick board, it's lost all its flex and recoil. Where epoxy is a much stronger matrix, and it if you combine it with the right materials, that flex pattern is a lot different. Oh, epoxy boards float higher. No, they don't. They don't float any higher. You take a epoxy board, it doesn't matter what the board's made out of. If it weighs the same and displaces the same, it's going to float the same, pretty much, right?
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than 1 billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's LinkedInJobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
The difference between the two is that the epoxy EPS foam boards are not bending as far, and they're recoiling quicker.
Sure.
So apparently when you're paddling them, they're floating higher, only because you're not bending them and mushing them out
yeah.
as much as you would with a polyester urethane board. So back to the molded board. The molded board, because of its structural nature, is stiffer than both epoxy or polyester. And consequently, it took a little bit more in design to compensate for that, and some people just don't like it.
Yeah.
Because they're used to what they're used to, and maybe in their own mind they can't accept it. I don't know.
Preconceived, yeah.
But you know, you slightly change your style or whatever. I'm not saying it's for everyone.
No,
and
of course.
I'm not saying it's going to be better than a custom board. But it definitely has its place. And when we started dialing in the designs, the weight to strength to flex characteristics, the production boards got a lot better and better and better and better as they went along. And,
right.
And you know, if you did a double blind test,
right.
I bet you'd be hard pressed to find very many people that could tell the difference.
Right. Okay. Can I offer you an analogy
yes.
and ask you your
Please.
Opinion on it?
Sure.
I'm into wine. I like wine. Okay. And Kendall Jackson makes a manufactured style of wine that is replicable from vintage to vintage. And you can go to any grocery store in the country and find that exact wine. 2011 tastes the same as 2010. I don't really drink Kendall Jackson wine. I'm not looking for the replicable Coca-Cola experience. But my favorite wines come from wineries that it's a farmer working his land that maybe he got from a previous generation, his father and their father. So there's all this history steeped into the land. And technically, the wines have flaws. And one vintage may be significantly flawed. And one vintage may be a home run, you know, and that's the one you fall in love with. But you go to the winery every couple years, or there's one specific wine that a friend gave to my wife and I one time when we were in Napa, took it to dinner. We loved the wine. Consequently, we buy every vintage through their mailing list. Just every year, we're going to buy it no matter what. And it isn't to do with the fact that the wine is technically perfect. It's to do with the fact that we drank it together at dinner in Napa that first time, and we know the winemaker and his wife and their dog, and we've been in the vineyard, and there's all this sentiment attached to it. And even though one vintage may be technically flawed, I appreciate that flaw, and I like the characteristic of that flaw because I know all this sentiment attached to it, you know? And when that perfect vintage comes, I enjoy that even more because of all this history I have with that wine. And so price always matters, of course, but you know, you're buying into all this history and that the romance of it, I guess. And so I kind of use that as an analogy with surfing sometimes, where it's like, I'm going to buy a board from this particular shaper just because I know how hard the guy works. And I know that his hands toiled away, and I know his family, and that this money is going to, every dollar matters to him, you know? So I don't know what the question is, but I offer that as an analogy for surfing, where I can hear the listener criticizing the surf tech model in that it's stripped away maybe some of the romance of the experience.
And yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. But if you look at it like the vintner who is a shaper.
Yeah, exactly.
You just described shaping, you know.
Yeah.
There are good years and bad years, and you know, some of them are hits, and some of the flaws you learn from. And so if I shape a prototype for a production board to be done where, well, I got in a huge issue with a known shaper, designer, businessman, some years back, before he died, actually. We're having a forum, and it's a similar analogy was brought up, and you know, a lot of resentment against using the computer design,
right,
and boards that were shaped by a machine, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, wait a minute, you guys. So you guys have never done a close tolerance Clark foam blank? You've never shaped one? I don't think so. I think you have, and I think you've shaped thousands of them, and I know why. The blanks are so close that if you knew where to put the fin, you wouldn't even have to glass the board. Mm-hmm. You could actually surf that blank.
Right.
They're not that bad. Why did you do that? Why did you shape those and you didn't hack down a tree and start with this,
yeah,
you know, piece of lumber?
Right.
Why didn't you do that? Because guess what? You know, you got tired of eating air sandwiches. You had to make a living. You had to, you know, and you wanted to go surfing. So you made it as easy as you could to replicate your ideas that you've got 50 years of past coming up with.
Okay.
What's wrong with that? The art is there. Okay. And I'll go back to your analogy of the sentiment and,
yeah,
and all of that, of having that first great bottle of wine with your wife and how good it was. And I can remember that wave of Phil's.
Right.
Would it be better if I had had a camera and shot a video of that wave? That video's in my mind.
It arguably would dilute it if you were viewing it through the viewfinder.
Well, I know you're not, you know, not everybody's going to be in the shore break at Waimea Bay when it's triple, quadruple overhead.
Yeah.
But I'm having a brain fade.
Who?
Help me. Who does it?
Oh, Clark Little.
Clark Little, yeah, yeah. Sorry, Clark.
Yeah.
You're fabulous.
I know.
I mean, you're, you know, here's an artist who's in there, you know, shooting. I mean, is that like a fine wine? Or would you want to be in that shore break every day sort of experience?
I personally wouldn't.
No. So, I don't. Anyway. Maybe that's a poor
no.
way of looking at it, but I think both is valid. I mean, you're perfectly valid with what you talked about, and I can only rationalize, say that, oh, well, here's one other point that I had to make with the,
yeah,
same argument that,
yeah,
that, you know, have you guys done Clark foam blanks? I go, well, you know, what this has done for me, this production board, is the checks in the mail. What it's done is it's freed me up to be an artist.
Right.
It's freed me up to be able to create new designs and new ideas and go out and actually test them and keep progressing, you know, and not saying that production shaping is digressing, because it isn't, but I want to see a base. I like the base where that Clark foam blank, if it's perfect, it gives me a canvas that I can make subtle changes,
right,
to, one change at a time, and I can then follow that through the process and you know, find out where I was, where I am, and where I hope to be.
Right.
And so,
well, I think what you mentioned, I've actually thought about before, which is the surf tech model isn't a model that doesn't include artistry and thought and all of the shapers' past experiences. It actually includes all of that stuff to a more significant degree. And like you said, with more years of refinement behind it. So it's actually, the goal is to be replicable, but to get to that stage to be replicable, all of the artistry went into it.
Exactly.
So I get that too, for sure.
Yeah.
The replication process is where some of that is taken away, but it was all there in the to get
that's
there.
That's right. Yeah. And so now freed up as an artist again,
right.
Then I can take that, I'll give you an example. Early on in the SUP era,
right,
my 12-foot surf tech was one of the few boards that was big enough for the average paddler to stand on and paddle.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So using that as a base and being able to replicate it, I wanted to explore, had I been a true genius, I would have made that board 2 or 3 inches wider. I would have been king, but I didn't. So here it is. It's still a paddleable. You can paddle it, stand up, paddle it. I mean, say you as a beginner would have a little, you're a bigger guy, you'd have a little more problem on it than I would because I'm shorter and lower center of gravity and lighter, and so I would have an easier time learning on that board than you would. But I wanted to find out what the differences were in bottom contour. So I took one of my 12-foot boards, which even in the production deal, it's not perfect.
Okay.
Right? They're you know, but it's about as close as you can get. I mean, as good as Terry was at shaping, Terry Martin, you know, it was really hard to replicate an exact copy because he could do pretty well shaping, but then glassing is a little bit different. You know, the atmospheric conditions are different. The resin batch was different. The cloth batch was different. The glasser was different.
And of course.
So all of these factors weigh into the end result. So I took one of my 12-foot boards. It was pretty darn as close to the original as could be. And I drew an outline on the bottom. I took a tool and cut through all the skins and everything into the foam, and I peeled that bottom off. I concaved the bottom, and then I vacuumed that piece back down on it, and I concaved the bottom just to see whether it added to stability, what it would do to the overall design.
Hmm.
Well, in concaving, it takes a little rocker out of it. In concaving, it did seem to add to some stability. In certain conditions, it was paddled faster because it was a little more stable. Surfing wise, I probably would prefer it without the concave.
Okay.
And now that I'm a better paddler, I probably could paddle the softer bottom faster than the concave bottom.
Okay.
One. But it definitely, I learned a lot from that, and so that's why I can justify, at least in my mind, the close tolerance Clark foam blank or the machine shaped blanks that most shapers are doing. As Velzy so aptly put it, shapers today are scrapers, not shapers. And it's true.
Yeah.
You don't even have to turn your planer on anymore.
Yeah.
That's good. The planer's heavy. It makes a lot of noise. It makes a lot of dust. You know?
Bad for your back.
And it's hard. Physically, it's hard on you. You know, so okay, I don't have to use a planer every day. That's good for me. And again, because the check's in the mail, I can spend a little more time mucking around,
right,
doing an experiment like I did with my 12-foot board and learn something. So
yeah, I like that. It expedites the learning curve, basically.
I think so.
But the ultimate question is kind of what you said earlier, was if it was just a double blind study like if you gave me one board or gave me two boards, one of each, and I took them out in the exact same conditions, rode the exact same wave. This is obviously a fictitious study that could never take place. But if you could, then what would I pick? You know what I mean? That's all it comes down to. And there's no way to do that study, unfortunately.
So to add a little interest to your wine,
okay,
wine thing, I have a friend in Mexico that's a wine kind of wine connoisseur, and
yeah,
he's a very bright, funny guy, and I don't know whether he came up with it or not, but according to his, and he deals with some very wealthy people that are into wines, that are not afraid to pay $1,000 plus for a bottle of wine, right? And when you're talking price, you know,
with, yeah,
you know, Trader Joe's $5 bottles as opposed to, you know,
yeah,
their $2 Chuck, you know,
there's a qualitative
$5, but
yeah,
but much over that. Anyway, double blind test, and my wife, being a little more traditional, was appalled by it, but into a blender, turned the blender on, blended for about 30 seconds, poured into a crevasse.
Yeah.
Poured into that crevasse. and his vintner friends say their motto is, you know, life is too short to wait for wine to breathe. So
okay,
they're all over it. And we've done the sort of double blind test with it.
So it's the same wine blended versus non-blended?
Versus non-blended. So,
got it.
So if you want to test it on your own, pour half the bottle in the blender and take the other half, and you know, we use one of the mixer spouts and
Venturi
thing to help, yeah, breathe it a little quicker, and every single time the blended wine was,
it just aerates it faster, basically.
Aerates it faster,
but doesn't damage it in any way.
Well, you wouldn't do a, you know, you'd want to filter a $1,000 bottle,
sure,
of wine if you did it, and
okay,
maybe you'd want to breathe $1,000 bottle in the traditional manner, but
okay,
I'd love to get your feedback on.
I'll try it. I'll blend my next bottle.
And
see
at
how
least
goes.
No, he had a plastic blender too,
mm-hmm,
and which just, you know, Peggy just went, ew,
right?
And at least I said ours is glass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting.
And this all happened in Baja. This was down,
they make
there,
good wines down, oh, there.
They make some, right, very nice wines.
Yeah.
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 Guadalupe Valley, is that,
yeah,
what it is?
Yeah. We drive through there all the time. I mean, we're, you know, because we drive down there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so you have a house down there? Is that?
We have a place on the East Cape. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
So how much time? Do you divide your time then between Baja and Southern California?
We just started.
Okay.
Peggy retired. She was a special ed teacher and retired last Christmas. So,
okay.
So we spent 4 or 5 months this last year, and we'll probably spend at least that amount of time this year.
How much time do you spend traveling outside the country nowadays for surfing?
Well, that would be, of course, our big one, but you know, every other year, every 2 or 3 or 4 years, I get a chance to go to Australia, or, you know, I did that Chasing Dora thing in South Africa, and you know, I've done the Biarritz thing in Europe, unfortunately, traveling these days is not only very expensive, but flying is like such a drag.
It really is.
It really is. It sucks. And
especially if you're bringing boards.
Yeah. You know, I've been enough places and around enough. I don't have this great yearning to have to go somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Like in my book, you know, No Bad Waves, there are no bad waves, only a poor choice of equipment and a lousy attitude, and attitude being the most important. And so
I think that relates to kind of our conversation about surf tech a little bit, where we're getting so caught up in the mire of this discussion and what's ethically right and wrong, when in reality, whatever the appropriate equipment is, I mean, you have a lot of experience body surfing the wedge. That's a chapter in the book. And longboarding and stand-up paddling and everything in between. And it really seems like you said, there's no bad waves. It's all about your attitude. If you want to get fussy about where the board came from, you'll not enjoy the experience as much, you know?
Or that's just part of the great ambiance of being a passionate surfer, too. So it's not wrong. It's just, you know, I mean, I'm really fond of thinking and saying, you know, it doesn't matter how good you are or where you're riding or what you're riding, at the end of the day it's measured in increments of smile, you know.
Yeah,
it's how it went.
Yeah.
And you know, there, every day is a good day. Some are better than others, but every day is a good day.
Yeah,
the glass is always half full.
Can you tell me a little bit about the chapter, The Fountain of Youth?
Yvon Chouinard invited me to do an Indonesian trip and a boat trip, and we're on that trip with his son and a couple of his son's friends, and anyway, we got to surf all the hot shit breaks and you know. Good, bad, or indifferent, we did it, right?
What? And how old were you at this point? Or how long ago was this?
Oh, it was, well, I'm 77 now, so it was 10, 12 years ago, something like
mid-60s.
That. Mid-60s? So I'm in my 60s, right?
Got it.
And I'm still able to surf well enough I could pull it off. One of the incidences that led up to this final Fountain of Youth thing was we're riding Scar Reef, and there's a good reason it's called Scar Reef, because anybody that surfed there at any length of time is usually covered with scars. It's a pretty gnarly break, and we're anchored real close to it, and early in the morning, there's no one out. I paddle over by myself and catch a few waves, and then the couple of the younger guys on the trip paddled out. In fact, one of them, I think he was 17 or something, and I dropped into this terrifying barrel, managed to come out, and I just came out of it and shot over the top of the wave with this big shit-eating grin on my face, and you know, and the kid was just like totally dazzled. So the youngest guy and the oldest guy on the trip, and I was like 50 years older than he was, and so, you know, I kind of smiled. I went, I don't think I have to surf anymore today, and I just paddled back to the boat.
Really?
Yeah. So. You know, the next day we're on a 60-foot all-steel catch, and the next night we're headed around towards Desert Point, which is reputedly one of the best waves in the world. So we're in the middle of the night, you know, the trades are blowing, and we're reaching, which is a more or less ideal point of sail for that boat. We've got the diesel engine is on at the same time, 1,000 horsepower diesel engine in it, and we're trying to get around this point, and it took us 4.5 hours to go the next 4 miles because of the current. The current was so strong. Well, the current was headed in the direction of the Desert Point, going into the face of the wave. So now, you know, we're anchored quarter of a mile from the point, paddle over to the point, the tide's right for it and everything, and you have to imagine these waves are coming from the Antarctica pretty much unimpeded, you know, deep water, unimpeded. That swell is marching into Desert Point, and if you pictured the point as the axis of a the wheel on a bicycle and the spokes were the waves. That's kind of what it looks like. You just revolve that wheel and those spokes are waves coming into Desert Point. So unlike Scar Reef, Desert Point is an easier takeoff, but as it progresses out towards the rim, if you will, that wave gets bigger and gnarlier as it goes. Well, inside is a reef that's exposed, maybe foot or two out of the water. You've got this horrendous 10-knot current going straight into the wave face, and you are now opposing that current, right? So the illusion of speed is just phenomenal. I mean, besides, it's like a Mac and barrel wave.
Yeah.
So I'm on one of the set waves of the day, and I'm you know, to ride a wave like that, you have to be positive in your mind. You
To
go, I am going to make this wave, no problem.
Absolutely.
I'm going to make it, right?
What were you riding, by the way?
I was riding that board right there, which is an 8-foot balsa kind of pintail gunny board.
Three fin
thruster.
Okay.
So I'm pretty much hauling ass in this wave, and I'm again, because you have to be positive, I'm going, there's no way in hell I'm gonna make this wave. This is unbelievable, right? I'm so far behind, it seems like, in my mind, right, that I'm not, but I've gotta keep trying.
Gotta go.
You don't wanna, you don't wanna
can't
stop,
straighten
right?
out.
Well, unbeknownst to me, Yvonne has broken his board in three pieces. He is standing on the reef now, standing on the dry reef. I'm in this double plus overhead barrel, which is 20 yards from the reef, coming down the line, headed towards him. He's got the tail of this board in his tucked under his arm, and he doesn't know what to do, but he finally goes, I can't be standing on the reef, I'm out of here, and dives off the reef, lets the tail of the board go, but it's still attached to the leash that's still attached to his ankle, and he dives under this you know,
freight train
wave, right? And out of my periphery, I see the tail of the board, and I go, oh shit, I'm gonna hit a turtle. I thought it was a turtle.
Oh.
I didn't even know what it was. But I keep bending into this thing, and I make it another, I couldn't even believe it, I make it another 100 yards down the line in this thing, and finally just go rocketing through the top of the wave. And the only way I can really describe it is like taking acid. I mean, I had this shit-eating grin on my face. I could not get off. I was like so ecstatic and so elated that, you know, when I paddled back to the boat, and it just lasted and lasted and lasted. It was such an incredible experience because of the illusion of speed and the noise of the water and the wind, and the whole thing was just this amazing experience for me. Right?
Yeah.
So, month later, Yvonne calls me and says, hey, would you write an article for our catalog? Because, you know, the Patagonia catalog is famous for its, you know, articles on experiences. And so I thought about it, and so I wrote about that experience, and to sum it, the only way I could think of summing it up, and the more I thought about it, the more I felt like it was the real thing, is that Einstein said that if you and I are sitting here right now and you step on a spaceship and you rocket away, and you can rocket away faster than the speed of light, that theoretically you could come back and land, and you would be younger than when you left.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. Okay? well, they're starting to figure out that maybe you can, maybe not us, but there might be things going faster than the speed of light actually now. So in theory anyway,
sure,
that's what Einstein said. And in theory, I say that that experience was such a high experience that the illusion of speed was so great that I exceeded the speed of light and came out of that barrel younger than when I got into it.
Hmm.
And come on, look at Kelly. Right?
Yeah. It's a solid argument.
I don't think I have to say more about that.
Yeah.
I think it sums it up.
Yeah.
And that experience can be achieved climbing, you know, base jumping. You know, imagine that guy, what was his name, Bombard, who stepped out at 1,000.
Yeah, that GoPro stunt, jumping from outer space.
You know, and went over 800 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You know, his body alone, come on.
Okay.
That guy came out younger than when he left.
Well, I completely get what you're saying, and you can achieve it through other things, but isn't barrel riding different? I mean, can you achieve that experience in the barrel? I would argue is unobtainable through any other means. There's other means that might do something that's also really radical, but I don't know, that just sounds so majestic, you know?
Well, and look how lucky we are to be surfers. I mean, dealing with waves.
Yeah.
I mean, our whole earth is, our whole universe is all about waves.
Yeah.
You know, light waves, sound waves, you know, on and on and on. It's all about waves. And here we are, we're able to not only create the toy to make that wave riding, you know, more efficient, but we're able to ride that wave.
Yeah.
And have some feeling and knowledge about it.
Right.
And you know, there's another, well, you know, I don't know whether you want me to go into it, but
one of the other
parts of, you know, the book is about talking story, but it's really about the experience of riding waves and the fact that we are surfers. And surfing is such a unique experience. And one of the other great learning things for me was the experience of I'm with a painter friend in Baja. He's leased some land down there and he's put a trailer on it. And this is in the early 70s before Northern Baja was being developed and stuff. I had never watched a painting being painted, fully painted, right? Start to finish. And he painted in acrylics and he was really fast and he's a really good artist and painter. So we're standing on this bluff looking north with the halfway house on the bluff, sitting on the edge of the bluff, the ocean to the left, the mountains to the right. We're looking north. And he is painting and he's using a color in the mountains, and then he looks over to the ocean and sees a opportunity and paints in a wave and using that color, and then he gets another color, he's painting into that wave and what that wave is looking like and the influence around it, because you're looking at, you know, faded out in the distance 10 miles up the coast and back a few miles, and you know,
yeah,
what's happening right there next to him on the left. And now he's painting in the field, now he's painting in the halfway house, now he's over in the mountains, and suddenly all this blur of color is now starting to take form and shape. And the whole time he's painting the ocean, well, each time he's painting it, it's different,
right?
Because the wave that just broke is now going up and above water level. Well, the water seeks its own level, right? So it goes out in the form of a rip or a backwash or a tie, a idiosyncrasy that influences the following wave and so forth and so on. So, you know, it was, for me, when he froze that painting finally, when he finally finished the painting and froze that last wave, it was breaking. Because all behind that wave were these layers of influence and time, and I got to realize that our present is really built on the past, and how the past influences the present, and the present will influence the future. So it's this ongoing sort of series of waves that is your life, basically. And anyway, so to me, it was a huge lesson.
Yeah.
Just in reality.
It's interesting that painting was what crystallized that for you.
Well, because I could see it so clearly, you know, it was so clear in my, you know, just watching him, because he did the painting start to finish in 2 hours.
Mm.
Boom, 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 just like shaping a board. And you know, again, I think maybe that's why I was so fascinated with Joe Quigg sculpting a board, because it was all his past, you know. When Joe Quigg made his boat, it was all that past experience, surfboards and waves, that went into his boat.
Yeah.
And again, you know, back to the computer, back to the machine shaping, back to all of that. To me, that's why it's not really, it's important what your example of the wine, but it's all there no matter how it's expressed.
Mm.
And you know, maybe the computers will, you know, they're already smarter than I am for sure, but and maybe they'll be smart enough to really think, but
yeah.
But I don't think so. I think the creativity of the artist will still be
right.
Yeah. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's feeling alone, it's the weight of your load. It's a sliver of glass, it's life, it's the sun. It's night, it's death, it's a knife, it's a gun.
Final question for everybody who's interviewed is, what was the last surfboard that you rode?
Old surfboard or supfboard?
Either or. What was the last craft that you rode in the ocean?
Well, the last craft was yesterday at about this time, and I was riding my 710 sup.
Made by whom?
By me.
Excellent. And can people...
So I, you know, I shaped it, I designed it, I finned it. And finning, of course, is one of the black arts of surfboard design. And however the board's done, that finning is hugely important. So, you know, that's a whole other art in itself. And maybe an example of how complex and how deep the layers are in surfboard design.
Mm.
There's so much more to it than the skin, if you will.
Yeah. Was it about that time you get back out in the water today, or?
I'm probably going to ride a few.
Perfect.
Yeah, I put in about 3 hours yesterday, so I'm
Thank
a little
you.
Beat up right now.
Yeah.
In fact, I've surfed so much, you know. I started early in the week of Big Wednesday, and then I've been riding ever since, every day. So
it's the mud, a fish, a flash, a wish, a wing. It's a hawk, it's a dove, it's the promise of spring. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the end of despair, it's the joy in your heart.
That concludes our interview with Mickey Munoz, the basis of which was Mickey's book, No Bad Waves, distributed through Patagonia Books, and we'll have a link to purchase the book on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com, where we also have plenty of images and video of Mickey doing what he does best. Thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Surf Splendor. We hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Mickey, and we'll look forward to bringing you a brand new episode next week.
This is David Scales signing off for Surf Splendor and saying ciao.
Fechando o verão e a promessa de vida no teu coração. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. The stump of a tree, it's a frog, it's a toad. A sigh, a breath, a walk, a run. A life, a death, the rain, the sun. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart. São as águas de março fechando o verão e a promessa de vida no teu coração. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. Resto de toco, pouco sozinho.